We read in Genesis chapter 7 concerning the great flood of Noah's day that the flood was 40 days upon the earth, that is, in attaining its maximum mountain covering depth. And the waters increased and bare up the ark, and it was lifted up above the earth. And also, in Genesis 7:18, the ark went upon the face of the waters. And we have seen in verse 20 of Genesis chapter 7 that the very reason why God caused the waters to prevail at least 15 cubits upward above the highest mountains was for the sake of that ark. Surely Noah's ark was the greatest structure ever built by man to float upon the waters of the sea. It was far greater in size than any floating object constructed by man until the late 19th century huge metal ocean-going ships were first constructed. But Noah's ark was not a ship. It didn't have sloping sides and rudder, sail, and mast. It wasn't built to go anywhere through the waters. It was instead a flat-bottomed, square-sided barge. And therefore, it had one-third more carrying capacity than a ship with sloping sides of similar dimensions. Noah's ark wasn't built to go anywhere through the waters. It was built simply to float. As it sank deep into the sea, strengthened by the thousands of compartments built into it, and designed by no less than God Himself, through the blueprint provided 100 years in advance of the flood to Noah and his family. With the help of hired men, no doubt, and with skills that Noah had long since mastered in his nearly 500 years of experience upon this earth in the days of man's vast longevity and knowledge accumulation experience. It was entirely within the realm of possibility, with the time that God allowed to him, to construct this enormous barge. The barge was perfectly appropriate, not only in its shape, but also in its dimensions. We know, for example, that barges are ideal when they follow the basic pattern of being 10 times as long as they are high and 6 times as long as they are wide. This is something that confirms the rationality of the Genesis account, because that is exactly the proportions of this barge. By contrast, the Babylonians had an account of the great flood handed down by oral tradition, but unfortunately garbled and confused and rendered somewhat ridiculous through the passing of time, unprotected as their account was by divine inspiration, in which the ark of Utnapishtim, the Babylonian name for Noah, ends up being a gigantic cube with 9 floors, an utterly ridiculous structure, of course, from the standpoint of seaworthiness. But the Genesis account is exactly what we'd expect this barge to be in terms of its proportions, and even more remarkable, consider its dimensions. Not only was it 30 cubits high, that's 45 feet, as high as a 3-story building, it was 75 feet wide and 450 feet long. Thus, with its 3 decks, it had a deck area of nearly 100,000 square feet. And it had a capacity of nearly 1,400,000 cubic feet. Such numbers, of course, are very difficult to imagine. But if you've ever stalled at a railroad crossing while a slow freight train rumbled past, perhaps it would be helpful in terms of comparison to consider this fact. Noah's ark was so huge that 10 modern freight trains with over 52 boxcars each could move right inside of Noah's ark with extra space left over. In other words, Noah's ark had a capacity of approximately 500 and 22 modern railroad boxcars. And the significance of this is that all known air-breathing creatures of our modern world, approximately two each of all of these, with some exceptions, namely the types of creatures that were acceptable for sacrifice on an altar, in which case we had seven each of those, certain types of birds and domesticated animals, three pairs, and an extra. The extra being preserved through the year in the flood, in the ark, to be offered as a sacrifice of thanksgiving after the flood. If two each of all air-breathing creatures in the world today, and seven each of these ceremonially clean animals, were to be transported in railroad boxcars, we could comfortably accommodate all of them in only 150 railroad boxcars. Of course, this estimate is approximate. But Noah's Ark had a capacity of 522 boxcars. Therefore, it was more than adequate in size for its God-intended purpose of containing not only two each of all air breathers that are alive now, but also two each of all air breathers that have become extinct since the flood. And of course, there are 1,000 creatures even now in the world of air breathers that are on the verge of extinction. Two each of all that have existed basically since the world began. Plus food for them all. Plus room for Noah's family as well. The ark was appropriate then in its design, in its proportionate sizes, and also in its dimensions for its God-intended purpose. Facts that perhaps Noah could not have come up with in terms of a self-made blueprint.
Facts that perhaps Moses, who records the account
in this first book of the Pentateuch, would not have known even through all the learning of the Egyptians in his day, but which God knew and God provided for as an evidence, not only the rationality, but the supernatural character of the entire account. It's at this point that we begin to face some of the problems, the particular objections that men of science have raised in the 20th century in opposition to the historicity and rationality of the Genesis flood account. The scoffers and mockers of the last days today appear aplenty in various pulpits and theological podiums in the great schools of the Western world, raising questions, suggesting sarcastically the impossibility of taking literally and seriously the Genesis flood account. What are some of these objections? In the first place, we are told that even if such a structure could have been built at this early stage in human history by man, even with a God-given blueprint, it would have been totally impossible for Noah to have gathered to each of the air breathers to his ark, even if he spent the 100 years doing nothing else. And of course, we do recognize that this would have been a problem. In fact, we can go a step further. It would have been a hopeless problem. If Noah was left to his own ingenuity, it could never have been done. In recent years, a film producer near Rome attempted to stage depict the story of Noah's ark and the flood by constructing a model of the ark near Rome and hiring animals from zoos all over Europe and spending months training them to walk up a gangplank into the model of the ark at a given signal for the filming. When the time came, however, a very serious event occurred. Just as the parade began, a water buffalo panicked, crashed through the model of the Ark and headed straight for Rome, and the filming was called off. Why? Because even though that film producer had deliberately picked the kinds of animals that he thought would cooperate, and even though he had the help of many specialists to make this possible, he had to finally recognize that animal nature being what it is, such an event as depicted in Genesis chapter 6 and 7 could never be reproduced in the modern world. And he was right. The filming had to proceed by splicing together individual shots of animals that were coaxed especially for the occasion. We will then say, along with modern mockers and scoffers, that this could never have been done if it were the responsibility of Noah himself. So although Genesis chapter 6 does say in verse 19 that it was apparently Noah's job to bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive, we must also recognize that the next verse explains how that was to be accomplished. Not through Noah's ingenuity or efforts, but rather, two of every sort shall come unto thee, said God to Noah, to keep them alive. And so when we read in Genesis 7, verse 9, what happened 1 week before the flood came, we can see clearly that God brought the animals to Noah, and his responsibility for bringing them to the ark was simply to open the door of the ark that he himself had built. And so there went in two and two unto Noah, into the ark, male and female, as God commanded Noah. This was God's work, not man. And as this gigantic parade began, two elephants, two giraffes, two of this and two of that, for the 20, 22, or who knows how many thousands of species of air-breathing creatures, kinds of creatures, not varieties within kinds, two dogs, two cats, not 200 varieties of dogs, two representatives of each created kind, brought by God himself to this sole place of refuge in the presence of the impending catastrophe that would engulf the world. Many who had heard of Noah's warnings doubtless had second thoughts concerning the fact of the flood when they saw this unique parade of air-breathing creatures wending their way to this gigantic barge. But according to 20th century scoffers and mockers, this must have been only the beginning of problems for Noah, because even if somehow he could have built this ark, and if somehow the animals could have been brought to the ark, it is totally beyond the realm of human reason, we are told, to imagine Noah and his family surviving for a year cooped up in a floating menagerie with 40-odd thousand animals, which it was his job to calm, to control, to feed. And can you imagine the problem of sanitation and cleanup that would be confronted by this little family of 8 people? Here again, I must confess that it would have been an impossible task if it was left to his own ingenuity and resources. In fact, we may be sure of this, that after only 2 or 3 weeks of such efforts, Noah himself would surely have been a candidate for suicide to end it all and to terminate this hopeless situation. But instead of chaos, confusion, and frustration, what does the Bible tell us to have been the condition of things inside that barge? during a later phase of the flood year. Notice Genesis chapter 8, verse 1. 5 months have now passed. All mankind has returned to clay. To use an expression from the Babylonian Gilgamesh epic in its description of the flood and its global destructive effect. And what do we see inside the ark? Chaos? Confusion? No. God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. What does that mean? If you know anything about the God of the Bible, you may be sure it does not mean that God was so busy bringing the flood for 5 months that he temporarily forgot about Noah and the occupants of the ark. As if God said to himself, "Oh yes, there's Noah and the animals," and God remembered them. Is that the kind of a God that you know of? Well, it's not the God of the Bible. Because our God knows all things and doesn't have to be reminded. He doesn't have to remember in the sense of having once forgotten anyone or anything. What does this expression mean when it's applied to God? And it does appear frequently in the Old Testament. It means that God takes special care of someone, providing for all their needs. What word did the thief on the cross used in his hour of need? What did he say to Jesus on the adjoining cross? He said, "Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom." He certainly didn't mean recall that I was on the adjoining cross. Small comfort that would have brought him. He meant, "Lord, when you enter your kingdom, provide for all my need, spiritually, supernaturally." And Jesus knew it and answered accordingly. "Verily I say unto thee, this day shalt thou be with me in paradise." That is one of the most dynamic terms in the Old Testament scriptures. Remember, God, remember me. The Lord remembered him. Now, as you look then at Genesis 8:1, here's the message that we gather. 5 months have passed. The world has been devastated by the swirling masses of sediment-saturated waters. And what about the ark and its occupants? God remembered Noah. That is, God took special care of Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle with him in the ark. Wild animals, domesticated animals. God took care of them. God provided for their needs, not Noah. And therefore we may be sure that not chaos, but control and calmness, incomparable calmness, prevailed in the interior of that ark. How do you think God controlled the animals? I would like to offer this suggestion. As God brought them to the ark, two by two, into the thousands of compartments designed and provided for them, and they partook of the food that Noah was instructed to provide for them, God then put them to sleep in a supernaturally imposed hibernation experience, for which all animals are capable under extreme circumstances, but as a miracle of God's provision. The ark was built for two of each. They went in two by two. A year later, including the rabbits, they came out two by two. In other words, God obviously controlled the wild natures of these creatures during this year of crisis, a reenactment of pre-curse conditions in Genesis 1, of millennial conditions in Isaiah 11, where even lions will eat straw like oxen. God's special control of these creatures is obviously provided for in this passage, which does shed new light upon Genesis 8:17. When the flood ended a year later, we are told that God commanded Noah to bring all of these animals out of the ark, that three things could begin to happen 1. That they may breed abundantly in the earth, not in the ark. 2. Be fruitful. 3. Multiply upon the earth. And so, the processes, the normal processes of life, of reproduction, of feeding, began. As these creatures emerged from that gigantic barge and found the world bereft of all competition, floating seedlings and rafts of vegetation had had 7 months to spring up like that olive tree, to new life to cover that part of the world with a blanket of green. And the wide, ever-widening concentric circles of the population explosion of the animal kingdom soon filled the world with their kinds again. Fantastic problems about this flood being universal. Where did all the water go when the flood ended if it covered the earth? What visible effects do we have of that deluge? These and other questions we must reserve till our next lecture, number 8, on the flood and modern geology. But one thing is clear. Genesis teaches a universal flood. And if it does, then the Apostle Peter, in 2 Peter chapter 3, in his appeal to this passage, was not twisting, but carefully explaining the full impact of that analogy in Genesis 6-9 for what will yet happen at the end of the world. Notice now 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. The heavens that are now, since the flood that is, and the earth, by the same word of that omnipotent God that created it and then destroyed it in the deluge, by the same word have been stored up for fire, being reserved against the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. What kind of fire is coming? Notice verse 10. The day of the Lord will come as a thief, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, the elements shall be dissolved with fervent heat, the earth and the works that are in shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things are thus to be dissolved, what men or persons ought you to be in all holy living and godliness, looking for and earnestly desiring the coming of the day of God, by reason of which the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. There will be no more flood of waters to cover this earth, according to the rainbow covenant promise of Genesis chapter 9. But there will be a flood of fire, triggered by the same God who destroyed the world by water at the dawn of human history because of human sin and rebellion, by means that He has already built into this planet and into the very atomic structure of the universe. Scientists used to laugh at 2 Peter 3. What does this mean, elements melting with fervent heat? They were earlier in the 19th century than before, from the time of the Greeks, committed to the atomic theory of matter in its original form, namely, that the basic physical building blocks of the universe are indestructible, can't be split, permanent, solid. Because atom means something that can't be split in Greek. But we have learned some things. We have learned that there is no such thing as an atom as such, because the basic physical units of our world are not solid, permanent substances. But they are nothing but negative bits of energy called electrons whirling at fantastic speeds around the central nucleus of the opposite charge, which under proper conditions can be split to the release of heat and energy sufficient to destroy the world. And this earth can be compared to a gigantic bomb with a fuse nearly burned out, held together only by the hand of the God who made it, and whose long-suffering and patience with men perpetuates yet longer an opportunity for men to believe and to be saved. How can men escape this coming flood of fire? Only by the kind of faith that Noah had in his day. According to Hebrews 11:7, it was by faith that Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, built an ark to the saving of his house, whereby he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. What kind of faith did he have that spared him and his family through that deluge? Being warned of God of things not seen as yet. He was moved with fear. I'm sure the scoffers of his day could have approached him on his high plateau, observing his ark being constructed, and have challenged him with these words, "Noah, what are you doing? You say there's going to be water from above and from the oceans beneath. Don't you realize that all things have continued as they were from the beginning of the creation?" And I'm sure Noah could have answered, "Men, I understand perfectly what you're saying. I haven't lived on this earth 500 years for nothing. I know very well that it's never rained. There's never been an oceanic flood. But I know that God is able to keep His warning concerning things not seen as yet. And if you believe God, you can join me in this ark and thus be saved from the coming flood." No one believed him. They all died in the deluge. Jesus put it this way, "As it was in the days of Noah, so will it be at the end of the age. For in those days," said Jesus, horribly describing the animal-like level of man's existence apart from faith and obedience to God's word, which was true of Noah only. "In those days," said Jesus, "men were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage." That is, feeding and reproducing, period. Until Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. So will it be when Christ comes. Increasing indifference, worldliness, men setting their roots deep in this earth system. Even the church, increasingly dominated by scoffers, walking after their own lusts and saying, "Where is the promise of His coming?" But there is an ark that God has provided for those who believe His word concerning things not seen as yet. It's not an ark of wood. It's a person, Jesus Christ Himself. Jesus said, "I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved." Jesus said, "I am the way. No man cometh to the Father but by me." Jesus said, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And if you take Jesus at His word, and believe that He died for your sins, rose from the dead, that He is coming again, and entrust your heart and destiny to Him, God will, as it were, close His hand of protection and security upon your soul and carry you through the coming fiery destruction of this world and land you safely upon the shores of a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. God keeps His word. Only by faith in His word, even concerning things not seen as yet, can you and I escape the fiery flood of judgment that is coming, and to be saved by God's gracious provision through Christ. That is God's message to modern man, through the illustration, through the history of the Genesis flood.